Ladies and gentlemen, in the last lecture, I defined the fundamental nature of a proper political system, a system built on the inviolate supremacy of individual rights. Tonight I shall discuss the mechanics of the economic system that is the logical corollary of a political system of limited constitutional government. I shall discuss the economic system which has been mankind's greatest benefactor and which has been most reviled and denounced, capitalism. Economics is the science that studies the principles governing the exchange of material values and the production of material values in relation to exchange. Capitalism is the economic system based on the private ownership of the means of production. It is a system in which men freely produce and exchange goods and services. Unregulated and uncontrolled by any governmental, any coercive intervention. A fully consistent capitalism, a fully free society, has never existed. But in the 19th century America, men came closer to it than at any other time or place in history. Today, few people really understand what capitalism is. Most of them, however, regard it as evil, old-fashioned, passé, which means that they regard freedom as evil, old-fashioned, passé. If one contrasts the standard of living and mode of existence of the average American with that of the medieval serf, the difference is truly staggering. The medieval serf ate his meals off an earthen floor in a hut held together with mud. He worked 18 hours a day and lived in chronic terror of plagues and famines that periodically wiped out hundreds of thousands of lives. The richest and most powerful feudal lords lived in conditions that a modern American worker would regard as squalor. They had no bathrooms, they had no underwear, they shivered in winter windswept castles and died of epidemics now long forgotten, except in the history books of medicine. The simplest living amenities that we take for granted, soap, canned vegetables, radio, central heating, would have been regarded by them as unimaginable luxuries. What made this startling transformation in man's mode of existence possible? What was responsible for this incredible increase in wealth and standard of living of the lowest individual? What makes wealth possible? Which means, what makes life possible? Wealth, that is, physical goods, physical values, is a necessity of man's survival. Wealth is not simply paper money. It is not paper that feeds and clothes and shelters you. Wealth is material goods. Without material goods, without material values, man cannot exist. But wealth has to be produced. Wealth is created by transforming the materials of nature to serve human purposes, by transforming ore under the ground into the steel girders of apartment buildings, by transforming seed into a harvest, by transforming a waterfall into a source of electric power. All wealth is the product of man's mind and labor, a thought directing action. Wealth is not the product of instinct or muscles, it is the product of human intelligence. If man lived on a desert island, he would have to produce single-handedly all the goods he needed. He would have to work incredibly hard to scrape out the barest level of subsistence. He would have to do his own hunting and fishing, build his own shelter, and fashion his own clothes. But living and dealing with other men under a system of the division of labor and the exchange of goods and services, man's efforts are much more productive and yield him a much higher standard of living. Through specialization and exchange, men are able to raise their mutual productivity. That is, they are able to achieve many more values for the same amount of effort or for less effort. There are a number of reasons for this. First, by concentrated specialization upon a specific activity, men are able to achieve a much greater skill at their particular task than if they had to diversify their activities across 100 different endeavors. For instance, if a man spends all his time making shoes, he will learn how to make them better and faster than if he had to divide his time among making shoes, growing food, building a shelter, and so forth. If he then trades with men who have specialized and therefore have gained higher proficiency at other tasks, his efforts and theirs bring them all a higher reward. Secondly, all men are not equally competent and able to perform all types of work. The division of labor makes it possible for men to do that which they can do best. Even if Hank Reardon, for example, could sweep floors more efficiently than the janitor in his factory, it would still be more advantageous to them both for Reardon to delegate the task of floor sweeping to his janitor in order to have his full time for his industrial activities, which he can perform, but which are beyond the competence of his janitor. Third, different geographical areas do not contain identical productive possibilities. Some areas are suitable for mining, others are more suitable for agricultural development, and so forth. It is clearly most productive for those different areas to be used in the manner for which they are best suited, and for the men in those different areas to exchange the results of their work with one another. Fourth, there are a great many activities and tasks that are beyond the power of a single, isolated individual. One man alone cannot drill through a mountain, nor run a railroad, nor build a skyscraper. This is equally true for the creative mastery of the many sciences necessary for the maintenance of an industrial, technological civilization. Specialization and cooperation are indispensable for such achievements. But there is one fact that must not be forgotten. No matter how complex social and economic organization becomes, and no matter how specialized human activities, the basic nature, meaning, and purpose of productive work must always be remembered. That is, that a man works for himself. He works to maintain his own survival. This would be perfectly clear to everyone if each person worked alone on a desert island or a self-sustaining farm. It would not be assumed that the purpose of a man working on a desert island is to provide for the survival of some man living on another desert island. But this is what is forgotten or blanked out by too many people when they look at the complex economic interrelationships that exist among men in a trade society. It is assumed, in effect, that the purpose and duty of the man who specializes in manufacturing shoes is to provide the community with shoes. That this, and not his own survival and needs, is his goal. That service to the needs of the community is his primary moral obligation. Unfortunately, too many businessmen, infected by the altruist morality, have accepted this creed and have rushed to announce that they are only public servants. That the goal and justification of their work is not the profits they make, but the employment they offer and the goods they distribute. Remember, therefore, that the motive of social organization and the division of labor is the self-interest of the individual persons who participate. In a free trade society, interests of men do not clash. All can profit from the exchange of goods and services. But social good, as apart from or against individual good, is not the purpose or justification of trade or of society. Now let us look at the operations involved in the free trade process itself. When men trade with one another on a free market, it is the law of supply and demand that determines the prices at which goods and services are bought or sold. When the supply of a commodity is greater than the demand for it, the price of the commodity falls. When the demand for a commodity is greater than the supply, the price of the commodity rises. Needless to say, in this context, people's demand for a commodity does not mean merely their desire for it. It means their desire plus their ability to pay for it. If two individuals engaged in a private trade, the price they agreed to would be set at the meeting point of their mutual self-interest. That is, the price would be set at that level where the seller considered it to his self-interest to part with the commodity in exchange for the money, and the buyer considered it to his self-interest to part with the money in exchange for the commodity. It is the aggregate of many such individual choices that determines the prices in a market. The relationship of prices to supply and demand is reciprocal. At any given time, prices are determined by supply and demand, and in turn they subsequently affect supply and demand. If many people want a commodity that exists in comparatively limited quantity, the price of the commodity will rise, since people would be willing to pay more for it. But as the price rises, it becomes increasingly profitable to produce that commodity. The businessmen already producing it will have an economic incentive to expand their operations and produce more of it, and the high profit margin will attract other businessmen to produce it. As a consequence, the supply will rise. When the relationship of supply to demand alters so that companies have to compete for a market in which demand is no longer in such excess of supply, or in which demand is now less than supply, prices will be driven downward. If the demand for a commodity decreases and prices and profitableness correspondingly fall, production of that commodity will be reduced. Businessmen will turn to invest their efforts elsewhere in fields where, relative risks considered, higher profit margins are possible. Their self-interest will impel them to produce commodities in more urgent demand, or for which they can anticipate a more urgent demand. Neither prices nor profits are determined by any individual's arbitrary whim. Capitalists do not raise prices because they are cruel, and they do not lower prices because they are kind. If a capitalist places his price above the market level, he will lose customers to his competitors. If he persists in the policy, he will be forced out of business. If he places his prices below the market level and eliminates his own profit margin, again, he will be forced out of business. Across an entire society, the economic interrelationships among various industries and between the production of consumer goods and capital goods is extremely complex. But it is still the basic law of supply and demand that constitutes the heart and essence of the market mechanism. Just as the law of supply and demand determines all other prices, so it determines that category of prices which is called wages. Wages are the prices paid for human labor. A worker, selfishly and properly, does not want to work for less than his market value. An employer, selfishly and properly, does not want to pay him more than his market value. Most people regard the worker's desire as just. They regard the employer's desire as predatory greed. When labor unions demand that prices be lowered and wages be raised, they are demanding that everyone's prices be lowered except their own. Their self-interest, they declare, is not evil, but the employer's is. Why has the employer no right to his self-interest? Why, because it is he who made their livelihood possible. This is the economics of the morality of altruism. Just as people do not condemn the worker who seeks the highest wages possible, so they do not condemn the consumer who seeks the lowest prices possible. They do not condemn a worker who shops among several possible employers in order to obtain the best wages and working conditions. They do not condemn a consumer who shops in several stores in order to obtain the best bargain. But let a businessman pursue the same course of self-interest. Let him shop among workers in order to obtain the best services at the lowest wage. Let him seek to get the best price for his goods, and he is denounced as vicious, as immoral, in effect as an enemy of society. I'm sure you have all heard such expressions as a fair wage, a just price, a reasonable profit. The implication of such statements is that economic values are intrinsic, that is, that in the eyes of God or of social planners, there is one inherently right price for every good or service, and any other price is wrong, unfair, unjust. Such a view reflects a total ignorance of what economic values are. It's a perfect example of context dropping. Neither food, nor automobiles, nor human labor have any intrinsic value whatever. Their value can be determined only in the context of supply and demand. And just as supply and demand do not stand still, but alter according to varying circumstances, so there is a constant necessary readjustment of prices. For instance, at the present time, a loaf of bread costs roughly 25 to 30 cents. And that is the objective value of bread right now. Since the quantity of the demand for bread remains relatively constant, if the supply of bread were suddenly to increase, a loaf of bread might cost only 15 cents. And at that time, and under those conditions, that would be the objective value of a loaf of bread. If, due to adverse agricultural conditions, there were a sudden dearth of bread, the price might go up to a dollar. And a dollar would then be the objective value of a loaf of bread in that social context and condition. Who will say what is the intrinsic value of bread, and by what standard will he presume to judge it? Economic value can be determined in one manner only, by the voluntary choices of all those who participate in the market, all those who buy and sell, work and employ, produce and consume. When social planners claim the right to decide what is a fair price, a just wage, or a reasonable profit, they arrogate to themselves the role of a dictator who imposes his wishes on others at the point of a gun. It is a gun that they regard as kind, all those who regard the free market as cruel. Profits are made possible only by the creation of wealth. That is, by so organizing the factors of production as to create a commodity that possesses greater value than that of the resources necessary to create it. To give a simplified example, when a steel manufacturer uses iron ore, limestone, and coal to produce steel, he is creating wealth because the steel is worth more than the sum of the separate values of the iron ore, limestone, and coal. Profits are the difference between a businessman's costs and the payment he receives for his goods. In a wider and deeper use of the term, wages may also be regarded as profits, the profit of the worker for the investment of his energy. Profits are not an artificial appendage of production. Profits, in this wider sense, meaning income and production, are identical. An excellent statement of the relation between profit and production is given by Isabel Patterson in her book, The God of the Machine, from which I quote. Quote, production is profit and profit is production. They are not merely related, they are the same thing. When a man plants potatoes, if he doesn't get back more than he put in, he has produced nothing. This would be obvious if he put a potato in the ground today and took out the same potato tomorrow. But it is all the same if he plants one potato and gets only one potato as a crop. His labor is wasted. Then he must starve, or someone else must feed him if he has no reserve from previous production. The objection to profit is as if a bystander, observing the planter digging his crop, should say, "You put in only one potato and you are taking out a dozen. You must have taken them away from someone else. Those extra potatoes cannot be yours by right," unquote. Income, wealth, and production are identical phenomena viewed in three different respects. Wages and profits are the monetary equivalent of that which has been produced. They are a corollary of production and cannot fluctuate independently of it. It is only an increase in production that can make an increase in income, in profits and wages, possible. It is not the whim of labor leaders that make possible a rise in real wages, just as it is not the whim of businessmen that makes possible a rise in profits. An increase in wages or profits depends on an increase in productivity. What does an increase in productivity depend on? Human intelligence. the discovery of how to make more products more efficiently, or the discovery of how to make new products. Profits are not achieved automatically, as no value can be achieved automatically. The fact that a businessman opens a factory, purchases raw materials, hires workers, and proceeds to manufacture some commodity does not guarantee that he will make a profit. It does not guarantee that he will be any more productive than the man who first plants and then digs out the same single potato. Profits depend upon successful economic calculation. That is, they depend upon the ability of the businessman to know what to produce, when to produce it, and how to produce it. If a businessman manufactures a commodity for which there is insufficient demand, he will not make a profit. He will have wasted his energy and his capital. He will have dissipated wealth rather than creating it. If he manufactures a commodity uneconomically and inefficiently, so that his costs are significantly higher than those of his competitors, and he cannot sell at their prices except by taking a loss, again, he will not make a profit. The bankruptcy courts are filled with men who believed that it takes no intelligence to make money. At the center of economic activity in a capitalistic society stands the enterpriser, the entrepreneur, the man who assumes the responsibility of solving the enormously complex problems entailed in the manufacturing and marketing of a product, the man who invests capital and organizes the factories of production. If you want to understand how crucial is his role, you might picture a society from which he suddenly is gone. Let's say there are natural resources, there is a large potential working population, either standing idle or functioning on the lowest levels of productivity. There are scientists and inventors, perhaps making important discoveries and even designing new worthwhile products, but doing so in private, in isolation, with no practical use being made of their work. There are no factories, no manufacturing of commodities, no employment offered to the working population. Well now, if into the midst of this came a person who perceived the potential economic value of the scientist's and the inventor's work, if he opened a factory, created jobs, and proceeded to manufacture the products which the scientists and inventors had devised, making these products available to the general public, one would think that such a man would be hailed as a hero and a benefactor. But when he does come, he is reviled instead and denounced as an exploiter, as a parasite, as a robber baron. Who is that man? Well, of course, ladies and gentlemen, he is the entrepreneur, the innovator, the chance taker, the promoter, the financier, the industrialist. Why is he damned as an exploiter? Because he creates employment. Why is he damned as a parasite? Because he produces wealth. Why is he damned as a robber baron? Because he upholds his right to a higher reward than the janitor in his factory. Have you heard entrepreneurs and industrialists attacked for the vast fortunes they accumulate? Those fortunes are indispensable to the existence of an industrial civilization. Without large-scale capital accumulation, no long-term investments in factories and machinery and research in new inventions would be possible. The largest percentage of the capitalist profits are reinvested for the maintenance and expansion of his business. His profits are the lifeblood that keep the industrial organism living and growing. The small percentage he spends in personal consumption is virtually negligible against the context of an entire economy. If it were distributed among the general population, it would raise a single man's wealth by less than a dollar. Now, this last is emphatically not said as an excuse for the capitalist profits. No excuse is necessary. It's merely said to point up the economic ignorance of those who cry against profits and do not appreciate what life-giving function they perform. The motive of the capitalist and of every moral man is his own self-interest. But observe that in a free society, the interests of men do not clash. In pursuing their own selfish goals, the men of ability bring benefit to all those with whom they deal. Henry Ford, for instance, did not go into the automobile business for the purpose of benefiting society. His motive was selfish. He saw the opportunity of making a profit. because he discovered how to make automobiles more efficiently and more cheaply than they had been made before, and because there was a tremendous demand for automobiles, he made a fortune. The motive of those who bought his automobiles was not altruistic. Their purpose was not to help Henry Ford or to contribute to his fortune. It was to gain a selfish value, the automobile he had to offer them. Because the manufacture of automobiles became a highly profitable venture, other industrialists and investors were drawn into the field. Their motive, too, was selfish. They wanted to make money. Their role was not to serve society. But as a result of their actions, the supply of automobiles was increased, competition became more intense, and prices were forced down, making it possible for consumers to purchase cars more cheaply than in the past. Incidentally, it was Ford who forced prices down when he grasped that it was more profitable to sell more cars at a lower price than fewer cars at a higher price. It was also Ford who instituted the $5 a day wage at a time when his competitors were paying $2 or $3 a day. Why did he do it? Because he grasped that higher wages would allow him to engage the best working force and to obtain the highest productivity from those he employed. His motive was selfish, but he forced wages up in the whole industry. Why did the best workers come to him? Because they wanted to help him? Of course not. Because he offered them a better wage than they could obtain elsewhere. As profit opportunities in the automobile industry became less spectacular, industrialists, entrepreneurs, investors began to look elsewhere for new fields of endeavor, for more rewarding uses of their energy and wealth. Their motive was selfish. But what was the result? Nylon stockings, jet airplanes, wonder drugs, and television sets. Investment will necessarily be attracted to those businesses or industries that offer the highest returns, comparative risk considered. The consequence of that will be an expanded supply of the particular goods in demand. The consequence of that will be an eventual leveling off of the profit margin. When the profit margin is no longer significantly higher than that of other comparable industries, investment will begin to flow elsewhere in the direction of still more rewarding opportunities.